Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Jerry Pratt.
He never did anything particularly monumental in his life, but he lived on his own terms.
That and more. But first, listen folks, the other day, a woman named Emily emailed me saying, I'm a little disappointed that there have been no Palestinian stories or Palestinian voices on the show. At this time in history, that could be impactful. And I emailed Emily right back saying, I could not agree more. If you are Palestinian, or if you know someone who is, please reach out to us. And we can help you brainstorm on a story from your life that you could share on the show. We can help you prepare it and help you share it. There's plenty of helpful information at risk-show.com/submissions, but you can also just email me directly, just like Emily did, at kevin@risk-show.com.
We'll be right back.
Now here's the show. Hello, folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is Happy Hollows behind me now. And we're calling this week's episode Patreon Picks Number 4. About once a year, we like to give anyone out there who is not a member over at patreon.com/risk a chance to hear some of the bonus stories we feature over there. There are so many over on our Patreon now, and they run the gamut. Old stories, new ones, long ones, short ones, stories told in conversation with me, or prepped with music and sound design. It's extraordinary, the collection over there. There's also my check-ins, which are kind of like audio journals, and conversations with our staff, with therapists about stories, and more. So this whole episode is a reminder how much we dearly hope you'll join us over at patreon.com/risk. Without our listeners' support, we can't keep Risk running. Everyone on the Risk staff, myself included, is now looking for job opportunities because it's looking like we all need supplemental income in order to keep working for Risk. For some of us, Risk will still be our full-time job, very much our full-time job, but we need to start finding part-time jobs as well. Our financial challenges of last year, so far they're being matched by new ones this year. Remember, if you're already a member over at Patreon, you can increase the size of your donation. And if you have any ideas about how Risk could raise more funds, I'm at kevin@risk-show.com. Now, in a little bit, we're going to hear from Jerry Pratt. But before that, a story from David Feinberg, who you can find on Instagram at TheRealBNutsDLF. I swear to God, reading these Instagram handles is so tricky for me sometimes. David told this story for our live show in LA, but we wanted to give him a chance to go even deeper and have a little bit more breathing room with the story. So he retold it in this fashion you're about to hear. I should warn you, there is mention of suicidal ideation in the story. Here is David now with the story we call For the Win.
I've been a tennis pro for over 20 years, and I've been fortunate enough to play with some amazing people. When I was 7 years old, I was on summer break, and I remember my parents coming into my room and saying, David, we're taking you to tennis camp. Well, I didn't really know much about tennis, but from the moment I stepped on that court, I fell in love with the sport. I practiced nonstop and became somewhat of a tennis prodigy and wanted to be a professional tennis player. I spent so many hours practicing, and I actually achieved a respectable ranking. Then something changed. I started losing big matches. It started in high school, and then it really manifested itself when I was playing high-level tournaments. I would just play a great match, and I would position myself to win. And then, mysteriously, I would just fall apart and lose. And while I was playing these matches, when I was going through that, I would curse, I would scream, I would smash rackets, just having a tantrum. Now, I know a lot of you out there who play tennis are thinking, I just choked. And those of you who don't are thinking, wow, you're an asshole. Well, you're both right. You know, I know finishing matches is a very common problem with all tennis players, but my situation, it was different. And then the pain of playing and the losing, it just became too overwhelming. It sent me into a deep, deep depression. I started having trouble getting out of bed. I continued to have panic attacks. And my social life just disappeared. I had no interest in having any type of social life. So in college, I just quit tennis. I was done. I didn't want to play anymore. I didn't want to be anywhere near a court. After college, I moved to LA, and I got a job as a messenger. And one time, a colleague asked me if I would teach his toddler tennis. I hesitated at first because I hadn't picked up a racket in years, and I really didn't want anything to do with tennis anymore. But listen, I wasn't making much money, so I convinced myself it would be good extra income. So I started teaching, and believe it or not, it actually turned out to be a really nice side gig. I also started hitting again with a fellow pro named Lisa, and you know, we really had a good time. I really enjoyed it. Lisa was so cute, and I did want to ask her out, but I had such dysfunctional relationships with women, I didn't want to jeopardize our friendship. Well, Lisa entered a tournament, and she said I should too. Oof, that was tough for me. I was so worried about falling back into my old ways, it just scared the living shit out of me. So I basically just said, listen, I'm not going to enter, but I want you to play and I want you to have a good time. Well, she then says to me, well, if you enter, I'll have sex with you. So I entered the tournament and my opponent won the coin toss and he elected to serve first. And my warm-up was great. I was loving how I was hitting the ball. I was so comfortable out there. And believe it or not, I actually felt really confident. I'm like, all right, let's do this. And then my body just froze. I felt like I had a straitjacket on and I couldn't move. My vision became blurry. It's like I couldn't see the ball anymore. And now I'm thinking, oh, fuck, here we go. It's coming back. All my old issues that I wanted to get away from are coming back. So I was saying to myself, just be calm. You're going to be okay. You'll be fine. But it just didn't work. I just felt powerless out there. And it just got progressively worse. After a few games, I started screaming again, swearing. I was throwing my racket. And what's crazy is I knew Lisa was watching. But I couldn't control myself. It just didn't matter. It didn't matter that she was watching. It didn't matter that other people were watching. It didn't matter that I was making a fool out of myself. I had zero control. It's almost as if I turned into the Incredible Hulk and whatever happened, happened. After the match, I got severely depressed again, and I was embarrassed, and I didn't really want to see Lisa again because I was ashamed. And she said, "It's okay, I understand, but look, we both know she was disgusted with my behavior, as was I, but there was really nothing at that point I could do." I said to myself, "I'm done. I'm just done. I'm never playing another match again." Well, a few years go by, and the itch to play tennis came roaring back. Nothing changed. After each match, I'd suffer panic attacks, depression, and all my insecurities surfaced off the court as well. I would be driving home from these matches just furious with myself, and I'd be screaming at myself, "You're a fucking loser. You're a worthless piece of shit. No wonder you're not successful. Why would Lisa or any girl want to date you? You're a loser." I would start pounding the steering wheel. And then I would start hitting other parts of the car, like the passenger seat. I'd start smashing it. And then I started hitting myself. I started punching myself in the face. And then I wouldn't want to leave my apartment because I'd be so depressed that I did that to myself. I would call in sick at work, and sometimes it would take days. I mean days before I would leave my apartment. Yet I kept playing because I so desperately wanted to figure out why I can't win. Well, about 6 years ago, I started playing with a new client, and he was a really good player. Our agreement was if he won, he wouldn't pay my fee, which I thought was fair, right? Since I was the pro. One day we were playing, and I had my worst outburst since childhood. We weren't at the normal club that we were playing at because I couldn't get a court there, so we got a court at the local park. And there's a bunch of people around playing, mostly older people because it was during the day. And I was just looking around, I was watching how much fun these people were having, how much joy the sport brought them, which of course should have been me, but it wasn't. So while we were playing, I was just out of control. I was screaming at myself at the top of my lungs. Every time I would miss, I would say, "You fucking asshole." I would say, "Of course, see, there you go again. You have to lose, don't you?" I broke a racket. I smashed it so hard at the ground, which is completely embarrassing. Now remember, this guy's paying me to play, and I couldn't control myself. I couldn't control myself. He was probably thinking to himself, "What is this fucking lunatic doing? I'm here paying a guy to have fun on a tennis court." It just didn't matter though, because I basically willed myself to lose. After the match, we shook hands and I just apologized nonstop. I said, "Dude, I am so sorry. I'm sorry you had to see that. I was out of control, and it's not about you. I was out of control. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry." And he was fine. He's like, "Hey man, don't worry about it. Everything's cool." But when I got in my car, tears just started flowing down my face. At that moment, all my failures came front and center, and it was just too much to handle. The pain I was feeling was just stifling. I was driving around and I'm looking at the trees and the flowers, and there was no color there. All their bright colors were gone, and all I saw was just dark gray. And for the first and only time in my life, I was so depressed. I was driving home on Mulholland, and I thought about turning left when the road went right. That way, I would never lose another tennis match again. I would never feel the pain again. I would never feel the anxiety, the depression, the failure, everything that I was going through at that very moment. Then I started thinking about my own wife, my own amazing wife, and my two incredible kids. And I thought to myself, I can't leave them. I can't leave my wife. knowing that her husband took his own life. And I don't want my kids to grow up knowing that their dad took his life. So luckily, I regained my composure. That's when I realized that I can't do this on my own and I needed help. You know, in third grade, I started seeing a shrink who I really connected with. I gave her a call and I told her what was happening, and she was beyond devastated as well. And she said, listen, we have to start talking again. And I agreed. We started talking again on a regular basis. And what we quickly realized was this behavior had nothing to do with tennis. So we started talking about my childhood and the struggles I had. My mother is a very loving and devoted and caring person, but you know, she's not without her flaws. She would just snap at me out of nowhere and just berate me with this awful language. She would say to me, you're a worthless piece of shit. You disgust me. You don't deserve to have a mother. And the thing is, her behavior was so unpredictable, I never knew when she was going to snap. I guess the best way to describe it is if you're walking in a minefield, you never know what step is going to set off an explosion. That's what I felt like. I specifically remember one time we were getting ready for my sister's bat mitzvah, which should obviously be an incredibly joyous occasion. So we all had to be ready at 8:30 in the kitchen to leave for temple. I walked into the kitchen from my room and my tie wasn't on. My mother looks at me and had a total meltdown. Why isn't your tie on? I said, Mom, I don't know how to tie a tie. Dad does it. That answer wasn't good enough. So she started screaming at me. I remember her face, her eyes just like they were popping out of her head. Her nose, her nostrils would just like turn up and flare. Her shoulders would go closer to her ears. She was so tense. And her body language just changed. And she would say to me, how can you be so selfish? You're an awful brother and you're an awful son. Do you see what I mean when I say what a piece of shit you are? I started crying and I was completely distraught. Yet when we got to temple, we started taking pictures and she had a big smile on her face as if nothing happened. And of course, I wasn't smiling. And I remember the photographer, he kept saying to me, you need to smile, David. You need to smile, David. And my mother would say the same thing. She would have this beautiful smile. Her beautiful piercing eyes would just light up. And she would say, please smile, honey. I remember specifically, she turned to the photographer and she said, I'm sorry, he's having a bad morning. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm having a bad morning because of you. I just didn't understand, why did I deserve that treatment? Why would my mother talk to me like that? So she would regain her composure and I, of course, was devastated. This behavior happened way too often. It became a normal thing in my family. You know, my father, who I had a really good relationship with, most of the time he would just dismiss it and he'd say, just do whatever your mother says and it will stop. I remember always gravitating towards my dad for comfort, even if it was just a hug. And even though he stayed neutral, I just wanted that feeling of a parent loving you and protecting you and just having him say to me so badly, don't worry, son, it's going to be okay. One day my shrink said, it sounds like you don't feel like you deserve to win. And she was 100% right. But I kept asking myself, why? I think the answer is when my mother would say all those awful things to me, it stripped me of all my self-esteem and self-worth. So I guess I didn't feel worthy of winning. And this is going to sound crazy, but because losing was so painful for me, I unconsciously decided to lose so my opponent wouldn't have to deal with the pain of losing. Which is crazy because it's just a tennis match. And yet, when I did lose, I started saying all those terrible things to myself. So I basically took over where my mother left off. I would say I'm a piece of shit. I would say I'm a loser. I would say all that. And after breaking all of this down, I kept saying to myself, okay, we got it. We got it. Yet I continued to lose matches and I would still become so sad and so depressed. So something was still missing. A couple weeks later, my 7-year-old son and I were watching Star Wars Return of the Jedi. And remember that last scene when Palpatine, that freaky-looking bald dude, was killing Luke Skywalker with Darth Vader watching and Palpatine sending beams through his hands and Luke is yelling, "Father, please help me, please help me." And eventually Darth Vader grabbed Palpatine and killed him, even though he knew it would kill himself. And my son looks at me and says, "Wow, Dad, that's so cool." And then his inflection completely changed from excitement to sorrow. And he said, "Daddy, why are you crying?" I was bawling. I finally discovered the missing piece to this complex puzzle. My father. Why didn't my father protect me? Even Darth fucking Vader protected his son. I realized at that moment I had an underlying resentment towards my dad. A few weeks later, my parents came to visit us, and my dad and I, we took my son to baseball practice. I remember it was this big park, and they had multiple fields with a bunch of people there, and there was a ton of kids practicing. So when my son was practicing, my dad and I decided to walk around the park. I remember specifically that day, it was unusually hot. So I was sweating profusely. I was so nervous to confront him and ask him why he didn't protect me. After about, 20 minutes or so of feeling extremely anxious and nauseous, I finally worked up the courage and I confronted him. And I said, "Dad, why didn't you protect me when Mom said all those awful things to me?" He froze in his tracks and his face lost all expression, as if he knew this day was coming. And he was dreading answering the question as much as I was scared to ask it. You know, I had this whole situation in my mind playing out. I thought he was going to start crying and he was going to say, "Son, this has been bothering me my whole life. I am so sorry. I fucked up. I shouldn't have let that go on." But that was my mind, and that was not reality. He denied knowing about it and said he never saw my mother act that way or saw her say any of those awful things to me. Bullshit. We both know he knew. But to avoid conflict with my mother, he pretended like it didn't exist so it would go away. It was his responsibility to protect me. Yet he didn't. As a father, I would do anything to protect my kids. Yet he didn't protect me. That summer, we all went to Chicago, and my dad and I, one morning, we got up and we went to grab a coffee. While we were driving to the coffee shop, he brought up our conversation in the park, which made me realize it was clearly on his mind. So he said to me, "You know, you have to realize it wasn't easy dealing with your mom," and started telling me his struggles. "Oh, your struggles." As he was saying all this, I just started feeling all this rage build up in my soul. All the thoughts and emotions that I thought I suppressed all came up to the surface. He then said, "You have to understand something. She was suicidal." And that's when I snapped. I screamed and said, "I was suicidal. I was suicidal. Did you ever think how it would affect me? The kid, not the grown-up. The kid, me, a 10-year-old boy listening to his mom tell him every fucking bad thing he can say." I saw the pain in his face. I think he finally realized at that point what I went through, and honestly, what I was still going through. And for the first time, now he had to deal with the consequences of his parenting. That night after dinner, my parents called me in their room, and when I walked in there, they asked me to close the door. All right, so I closed the door, and I sat in a chair and I was looking at them and something was different. Something was off. They both had somber expressions on their faces. My mom said to me, "I am so sorry about how I acted when you were a kid." Honestly, I was not expecting that. I was not expecting this was going to be the conversation we were going to have. And she said, "There's no reason, none, why I should have said or done that stuff to you. There's no excuse. You have to understand that I had issues and I am so sorry. I'm sorry that I did that. There is no acceptable reason why that happened, and I'm sorry." And there was a sense of relief that ran through me. I just felt like, okay, I am not crazy. I didn't make up all this stuff in my head. I didn't have all these problems because my mother just didn't treat me the right way. And then my dad said to me, "Son, I'm sorry that I failed you. I should have stopped Mom from doing that. I should have taken you out of that situation, but I didn't. And I'm sorry." I teared up. My eyes just started to well up. And I said, "Do you understand what I have been dealing with? Do you understand how much pain I have been in?" And then they started tearing up and said, "Yes, we do. And we're sorry. It should have never happened. It's not fair that you went through that. And we are so sorry. And all we can do at this point is try to go forward. And let's work towards having a healthier relationship." So I said, "I accept your apology." And we all hugged. And we all cried. I remember my shirt just covered with tears from my mom and my dad and myself. We didn't even know whose tears were who. But after I accepted their apology, that's when everything changed for me. That's when I said, "You know what? I deserve happiness. I deserve to have a good life." You know, I've always had such a love-hate relationship with tennis. The tennis court, it became my canvas to paint all my frustrations. And it did send me into the doldrums of severe depression. But it was also the catalyst to take a leap of faith and improve my life. And I do love to compete today, but it still comes with struggles. I still have outbursts. And I know, sadly, they will never go away. But the difference now is I do feel like I have the necessary tools to help deal with them. Overall, I am happy and I am in a good place, but it takes a lot of work. My parents and I, we do continue to build our relationship, but the difference is I've set up boundaries now, and I've done it really to protect myself and just to make sure that certain lines aren't crossed. It's a lifelong journey, and there's going to be highs and there's going to be lows. But the difference today, as opposed to the past, I can look at the future and really be excited about where life is going to take me.
Begin talking before the 911 operator can say what is the nature of your emergency. I say, "It's a medical emergency. I have a 66-year-old man who has stage 4 pancreatic cancer. he had a bad reaction to his last chemotherapy, and he's fallen. We need somebody there right away. I called Bill back and put him on speakerphone so I could struggle into my jeans and sweatshirt that I kept in the closet for just this kind of occasion. My mind was racing, my body was racing. I wasn't thinking about anything but getting there. Bill said he fell at 1 a.m. and it was now 5 a.m. He said he managed to crawl from the bathroom into his bedroom, but he couldn't get off the floor. And I said, 1 a.m., why didn't you call me before? And he said, I didn't want to be a burden. I've been so much trouble for you already. I said, that's what I'm here for. We've been best friends since we met in 2001 at the Burning the Tax Man Festival in Corbett Canyon. He was the MC and I was the poster artist. He was a comedian. He breathed fire. He could juggle torches. He could juggle a bowling ball, an apple, and a grape. Everybody loved him. And he really wowed the crowd. After he got off stage, I saw him sitting alone in the crowd. And the people that had just previously been applauding him and cheering him were now completely avoiding him. And I can see why. Here was this massive man, a bodybuilder, 6'2", wearing a beanie pulled down low over his demonic eyebrows. His arms were folded, and he gave off a threatening vibe with his scowl, almost daring people to come near him. But his humor was so intelligent and so insightful. I took it as a challenge. So I walked up to him and held out my pipe and said, do you want to smoke a bowl? He held up his pipe and chuckled and said, sure. We ended up sitting there just chatting, talking about his kids and what it was like to be a parent and what it was like to work these festivals where everybody was celebrating and usually on lots of drugs. After the festival, we started running into each other everywhere. And we were just drawn to each other. We had philosophical conversations that I couldn't have with anybody else. He started coming over for a bite to eat and, of course, to smoke some pot. It was almost as if we could fill in each other's sentences. One day he says to me, you know, I really love you, but you're just not my type. And I thought, oh, thank God, because he's not my type either, no matter how much I care for him. We just were meant to be friends for life. I was still rushing around with Bill on speakerphone as I stepped into the foggy morning. I should have brought a jacket, but I'm so wound up, I don't even feel the cold. As we were talking, I climb into my little Honda. The windshield is as foggy as it is outside. But I don't think about anything but getting there. And all my memories are flooding through my mind like they just happened. I'm not even sure what I'm saying. I'm just trying to keep him calm until the EMTs arrive. I remember when we realized it was the final stretch and Bill didn't have much time left. We were in the oncologist's office. Bill was so thin that his clothes hung on him and his long hair was wild because he was too weak to even reach up and comb it and too proud to let me do it for him. He was sitting there looking at the floor with his elbows on his knees. The oncologist, Dr. Hjortsvang, asks him if he's in pain, but Bill won't answer. He just keeps staring at the floor. So I say, yes, he's in a lot of pain. Dr. H says, I don't care about addiction. You can have whatever it takes so you aren't in pain. We all know what he isn't saying, and that's that he won't live long enough to become an addict. When he was first diagnosed and we were told he had liver tumors, we thought, well, that's not so bad. The liver heals. They might have to make Swiss cheese out of it, but he can get better, right? We thought there was time, that he would have time to at least put his affairs together and do the things he wanted to do. But when Bill said that he wanted to go see his brother in the summer, Dr. H says, I can't guarantee that. It was only 2 months away. Bill continued to just look at the floor. He shook his head a little, but still didn't say anything. I felt like the air had been sucked out of the room and I couldn't catch my breath. I look around the oncologist's office. It reminds me of a school counselor's office. It's warm and there's photos of his family on the wall and a seascape on his computer screen. The sun is shining and the trees are blowing gently in the wind. And I think, this shouldn't be happening. There should be a storm or an earthquake, something to signify that Bill is going to die. And there is nothing he can do about it. After that, we sort of numbly walked through the parking lot back to the car. I put the walker in the back seat and got in, sitting beside Bill. Before I could start the car, he says, can we just sit here a minute? And I said, of course. And he put his head on the dashboard and began to weep. He didn't cry out. He didn't pound his fists. He simply wept softly to himself. And I didn't know what to do. I rubbed his back and squeezed his shoulder and just waited for him to get it out. And finally I said, it's okay. We're going to get through this together. I knew we were grieving for the same things. One day while we were living together, he got out his pins and went in the backyard. He didn't know I was watching him through the window as he tried to juggle. His brow was furrowed. I could see the determination and the sadness on his face as he dropped the pins over and over again. Eventually, he came back in, put the pins back in the suitcase, and put the suitcase in the garage. After that, we never spoke of it, but once in a while he would say, I don't want to be a broken old man. And that made me so sad because I remembered what a phenomenon he was when he was younger. As I am thinking of all these memories, I can hear over the phone the EMTs entering his apartment. "Mr. Geyer, Mr. Geyer," someone says. Bill says, "I'm in here. I know I need to get there, but I can only drive so fast in the fog." I make it just as the fire truck is pulling up in front of his apartment. I park and run through the parking lot. There is an EMT setting up a gurney outside his door. I nod to him and rush in. I pause at the threshold in horror of the devastation that has taken over his living room. Every paper that he has received, every piece of mail, is strewn about on the couch, on his recliner, on the floor. There are dirty dishes and empty glasses and just general debris. Everything he didn't want to deal with is just scattered about this tiny living room. It looks like a hoarder's worst nightmare. I rush through to the bedroom and stop again at the threshold. His bedroom floor is covered with dirty clothes and dirty dishes, electronic equipment, and more papers that he doesn't want to deal with. He's closed the window against the cold. The room is so stuffy. The air so thick with must and mold, rotting food, and man musk. I can barely breathe. His bed is unmade, and the mattress cover is filthy. He's laying there, curled up in a fetal position. His once massive form is skeletal now. I can see every bone in his spine. He looks so frail and weak, but he's still joking with the EMTs, who are so efficient and so kind. I wonder how they can do this every day, walk into such emotional poverty and despair. But they're chuckling and just going about their task, stabilizing him. They part so I can come in. I kiss him on the head and I say, "Hang in there, big guy. The roller coaster goes on." When Bill returns home from the hospital on hospice, he's pretty much bedbound. Pain and boredom seem to be the biggest issues. So I bring in some Bluetooth speakers. Being an old hippie, he wants to listen to the Grateful Dead and Warren Zevon and Frank Zappa. But one day, I put on Jane Seabury's Calling All Angels.
Santa Maria, Santa Teresa, Santa Anna, Santa Susanna.
And he begins to cry. And I begin to cry. And I think, oh shit, this is not what I had intended. So I put on Monty Python's Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, because I know he loves Monty Python. And he starts bobbing his head and whistling silently with the whistling parts. He's so emaciated, his bald head and his gaunt face, but his eyes shine with happiness for the first time since this all began. Later on, I say to him, "Oh, damn, I wish I had gotten that on video." And he says, "I didn't do that." And I say, "Oh, yes, you did."
Always look on the bright side of life.
When I'm at home, I scarf down a pre-made salad, smoke a lot of pot, and get as much sleep as possible. But one day, when I'm looking in the mirror, I look so haggard. My cheeks are almost as gaunt as Bill's. I've lost 30 pounds. My hair is out of control. I've got circles under my eyes. But then I think of all the people who have told me what a good person I am. I think, yeah, I am a good person. I'm kind and I'm a good friend. And I don't think I'd ever felt that before. I am a good person. One night, I get a phone call from Bill's number, but it's the caregiver. He hands the phone to Bill, and Bill says, "You've got to come. They're trying to kill me." I say, "I'll be right there." Grab my jeans and sweatshirt, which are still conveniently located in the closet, and rush over there. When I walk in, the caregiver says, "Oh, thank God." I come in and give Bill a kiss on the head, and he says, "They're trying to kill me. They're trying to kill me." And I say, "Oh, no, honey. No one's trying to kill you." He scowls at me and says, "You're in on it too. You're trying to kill me." I climb on the bed and wrap my arms around him. I say, "Oh no, honey. No one is trying to kill you. It's just your body. Your body's trying to let go." He holds out the phone in his claw-like hand and says, "Call 911. Please call 911. I say, "I can't do that." He says, "Why?" I say, "Because we signed papers saying we would not call 911. He drops the phone and sighs and says, "I'm so sorry. I thought I was going to be stronger than this." I say, "Oh, you are. You are so very strong. You are facing the most frightening thing that anybody ever encounters. The complete unknown is before you, and no one can go there with you." Finally, I calm him down enough to give him his morphine and Ativan, and he dozes off. In the last days, he is too weak to even take visitors. So I arrange for him to talk to his best friends. I sit on the bed with him and hold the phone up to his mouth as we call each one of them. I tell them, "He can't talk, but he can hear. Just talk about your memories and tell him how much you love him." It seems to take all of the effort he's got to say, "Goodbye, my friend, and thank you." When he has finished the last call, he lays back on the bed, and I'm holding him and stroking his arm, not saying anything, just being there for him. He lifts my hand to his mouth and kisses it and looks up at me with such love and gratitude. I am lifted like I've never been lifted before. thinking of all the love and companionship we have shared for the last 20 years. And I know how much I'm gonna miss him when he's gone. Since he's sleeping so much, I decide to take a day off just to sit in the backyard and watch the birds. I get over there in the afternoon, and the caregiver is standing there on the phone. She pauses to say, "You just missed him. He's gone." I go into his room, and he's laying there, his eyes half open, his mouth slack, his hands folded over his heart. And I wonder if I should stay in there and wait for the nurse to come. But then I think, this isn't Bill. Bill's gone. But I feel no grief. I am so relieved that the pain of his life is over. He no longer has to be a broken old man. And I honestly believe whatever is beyond the world of pain and sorrow. What he finds there, I'm sure, will be peace and bliss, infinite. When I get home, I tell myself it's okay to get drunk, but I don't. I am just so calm as I call our friends and let them all know. And they are so overwhelmed with grief. I feel like an outsider because I don't feel it. One friend in particular has gotten shit-faced and is weeping copiously. The more she weeps, the more I laugh. The more I laugh, the more she weeps. And I know I must sound insane, but I feel like both Bill and I have been released from the worries of this life. And wherever he is, he's with Warren Zevon and Frank Zappa, and he's got his dancing shoes on. I promised Bill I would tell his story because he was such a character. He enlightened us even as we were laughing. He enlightened me almost every day with his little tidbits of wisdom. He told me that if he told a joke and everybody laughed, he would not use that joke again because it was too generic, too elementary. He wanted to reach the higher mind, the greater intellect. He never did anything particularly monumental in his life, but he lived on his own terms with honor and dignity. He could be grumpy, but he was also very kind. And in his own way, he changed our world in monumental ways.
Falling and I'm running out of breath. Keep me in your heart for a while. If I leave you, it doesn't mean I love you any less. Keep me in your heart for a while. When you get up in the morning and you see that crazy sun, keep me in heart for a while. There's a train leaving nightly called when all is said and done. Keep me in your heart for a while. Sha-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Keep me in your heart for a while. Sha-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Keep me in your heart for a while.
This is Risk. This is Warren Zevon behind me now, who released this song just before he passed away of cancer in 2003. And we just heard from Jerry Pratt. You know, back when we could afford to take the show on the road, Jerry would show up with a few friends whenever Risk was in Portland, Oregon. And her and all of her friends would wear chicken hats. And then Jerry mailed me a chicken hat so that I could be a part of the coven. But mine was quickly torn asunder by my cat Quincy. He had a lot of feelings about that chicken hat. And when Jerry heard she was going to be on the show and filled out the little questionnaire, she said, "I'm an award-winning artist shown in galleries and featured at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. I am a severe neurodivergent who has thrived by reaching out frankly about being different and finding so much love, support, and encouragement. People like Wild Bill, who had my back in the worst of times and celebrated me in the best of times. My heart goes out to my fellow neurodivergents who feel so isolated and alone. Don't be afraid to be real. You may not always be understood, but you will be accepted by those who matter." Damn, brought tears to my eyes. Amen to Jerry for that. This world would be a much less wonderful place without neurodivergent folks in it. So thank you for sharing that, Jerry. I didn't know I was going to lose it there. Anyway, I hope that there is a sort of a Risk revival, you know? I hope that we get our second wind and enter into a new era of being able to tour with the show again and more other things. I've said it many times and I'll say it again. Come hell or high water, we're going to keep the show going as long as we can. And we still believe what this Patreon member named Julie said when she donated. She said, "Risk is vital." Another Patreon member named Jason wrote, "This podcast has made me laugh, cry, and has helped me change myself for the better. Risk has to stay around for many more years." And finally, a listener named Fred wrote, "Thank you for all the change, all the joy, and all the tears." I love you. We love you too, Fred, Jason, and Julie, and everyone else. You can become a member at patreon.com/risk, or you can increase the amount you are donating over there, or you can make a one-time donation at paypal.me/riskshow. And finally, if you have any ideas about other ways that Risk can raise funds, I am at kevin@risk-show.com. A Risk fan named Ryan, who runs a travel tours company in Europe, reached out to me and JC about creating a just spectacularly wonderful fundraising celebration of Risk's 15th anniversary this coming October in the wine country in Portugal this year. So you're about to hear a lot more about that soon. And we hope to hear a lot more ideas like that, like Ryan's idea, from the rest of you all. So just email me at kevin@risk-show.com.
We'll be right back. We're back.
Folks, on Thursday, we will have the best of Happy Stories number 2. But that is Thursday. And folks, today's the day. Take a risk.
Shalom.